This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Catherine, what is happening this week?
Okay, so this week, I think first up, we're going to do an update on our very profitable side business.
Hugely.
Do you remember that business?
I do remember the business.
So this is the business that's going to build us an empire and help us raise money to fund our second season. And we should actually say what we're going to use the money for.
Yeah, we should. We're not, you know, taking off to Europe on a holiday.
I would do that.
You did that already.
I did. That's good.
No, we have to, this season, we should say this, this season has been funded by our credit cards, but also very generously, RMIT, most importantly, supported us by giving us, Harry and Phoebe, two sound production students who used the production and the editing and the recording of our podcast as their major assessment. So they have done this like as unpaid interns. And you know what we want to do? We want to pay them.
Yeah.
We want to bring them on board for season two and offer them some cold, hard cash for their extraordinary work. So that's where the money goes.
So that's why we've been trying to start up a business. But I have realised that, and maybe this is no surprise to anyone, but having a really profitable side business is actually a lot of work.
Totally. Like, we can't, we actually have to make the tea, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So I pitched you three ideas, tea, Christmas cards, and temporary tattoos.
Tattoos, yeah.
I got quotes for tattoos. I came up with tea mixers, quotes for cards.
We went down lots and lots of rabbit holes. And people let us know what they wanted too.
Yeah, that was cool.
Tea, very popular. Very popular. Alan and Unwin tweeted at us that there was already, in fact, a literary tea company. Who knew?
Seems very obvious.
Yes, and great thinking. Hats off to them, literary tea company.
I bet there's a literary whiskey company. Don't you reckon?
Well, there's that literary whiskey. There's that bookshop that does whiskey and books anyway. So shout out to them too. All the good ideas.
Reinvented posters.
but yeah, so you got back to us. You really liked things. Our friend Meg said tea towels. We'd already thought of tea towels and we had a full design.
We did.
Amazing design.
But you need to buy about 400 tea towels before buy and sell.
Yeah.
And that was the other thing. We were going to be spending, and this was the best case scenario, that we would be spending a lot of time in the post office.
A lot of time.
The worst case scenario, it would be you and me in a room with 400 tea towels.
Yeah. No room even to write or to record anymore because it's just us and the tea towels.
Which is a good segue into the fact that maybe, you know, maybe we should be writing and not coming up with business ideas.
It's true. Some wise people have put it to us that maybe we're spending too much time doing other things and not actually working on our books. Whatever, people.
So we've come up with I feel like it's really innovative.
It's totally innovative. No one else in the arts world is doing this.
Fairly hands-off as well. What is it, Kate?
We are making a Patreon page.
Whoop, whoop.
Yay. I feel like there's even some little music I sometimes hear in the podcast.
Ask Phoebe to add something in
there. Where they do the Patreon. We're making a Patreon page. You will find us at the First Time Podcast somewhere on Patreon. We haven't actually got that link yet, but we'll put it in our show notes and everywhere because we need you, peeps. If you've been enjoying us, we need you.
So Patreon, what's the concept?
So Patreon is actually based on that really old idea of patronage where artists who never make any money but make great content, right? In the old days, great art, now great content. And people with lots of money just used to pay them to do it because they wanted to support them or to be seen to be supporting the arts. And so the artists could go about making their music or their paintings or their novels, not worrying about how to feed themselves or the children.
I'm so hungry, Kate.
I know. We are in the car. Can you hear our indicator?
We're actually going to dinner, so that's like a genuine statement of hunger.
It totally is. So what they've done with this Patreon page is a whole lot of whiz-bang clever people have got together and made a way for supporters to say, I would like to see some more of that. So I'm going to pledge, you know, 10 bucks a month. I, for instance, do this. I use Patreon. I pledge 10 bucks a month to Indigenous X, who publish a whole lot of Indigenous writers. Great content. So I pledge my money to them. It comes out in US dollars, but I get a handy little thing telling me how much that is each month. And I feel good. That's how it works.
Okay, so we have tiers of sponsorship.
Mm-hmm. So you can be a first level sponsor, which we would love. You will earn our eternal gratitude. All you've got to do is cough up $5 a month.
This is eternal gratitude.
Eternal.
So there's eternal. There's no expiry
date. There is no expiry date on the gratitude that will come at you from this. You pay $5 a month. You pledge that and you get our eternal gratitude. Okay. If you want more than gratitude.
Well, some people will want more than gratitude.
Mm-hmm. You could go up to tier two.
This is $10 a month.
$10 a month. That's $10 a month. You become a first-time fan. And so you don't only get our eternal gratitude, you also get access to a closed Facebook group, which you and I are both in, Catherine.
We are the total population of said post group.
So I tell you what, if you are the first person to pledge 10 bucks a month, it'll just be the three of us and you can have as much time as you need. I've gone too far. We've been talking.
Well, no, we actually lost.
No, it's all right. We're not lost, guys, but we'll keep chatting.
Tier three. So we start to enter an optimistic realm of tierage.
Mm-hmm, here. Mm-hmm. So tier three moves us up to $20 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're a first time loyal supporter or something like that.
There was a better name for it.
There was. I've forgotten what the name was. But anyway, at tier three, you get all of the above: eternal gratitude, closed Facebook group.
Trying to turn off the blinkers and put the windscreen on the side.
We're going to be late to our dinner. Everyone's going to be annoyed at us. Anyway.
Season two wrap party.
Season two wrap party. That's what you get. You get an invite to our wrap party, which will, of course, have some of our guests appearing in season two. It will have us. We'll go to somewhere fancy and you get an invite to that. We'll have, like, Christmas drinks for writers. Well, I don't know. What are we doing? Who even knows? You'll get this fine print when you sign up. And you know what? We thought we'd stop it there.
I didn't.
Catherine didn't.
Phoebe and Harry.
Catherine said, Kate, let's take it one step further. And I was like, what, you know, $25, $30? And Catherine said, no. Let's go all the way.
This is the legend tier.
Yeah, you become a legend tier. This is more than eternal gratitude. You give us $500 a month. And you get not only eternal gratitude, not only the closed Facebook group, not only the season two wrap party. In fact, I reckon you can host the season two wrap party if you can afford $500 a month. But anyway, you also get your own episode of the First Time Podcast in season two.
Or they can invite a guest.
They can invite you. So you can put a guest forward. You've got some obscure, incredible poet, friend.
Tony Abbott came on our show.
I mean, that would be somewhat of a coup, really, seeing as we're both such incredible investigative journalists. But yes, for instance, you might put forward a politician with alt-right leanings and we get to decide then whether or not they get to come on. Okay.
Okay, can people make one-off donations?
No, I don't think so. I've checked this. I don't think so. But you know what? If you've got some other idea, get in touch with us via Twitter or via the website and talk to us about your other concept for a one-off donation, and I'm sure we'll be happy to chat.
We will.
Definitely happy to chat. Okay, good. We found the restaurant.
Thank God.
We're here and hungry. We're going to leave you now with something we recorded a little earlier.
It's about procrastination.
We're very good at it.
So all of this effort, though, it did get me thinking, did you read an article that Bram Presser wrote on second book syndrome?
I did.
What, you mean we have to write a second book to build the empire as opposed to just making the things on an Etsy store? And there's a syndrome attached to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. And it resonated deeply with me.
As with me. So even though most of it was on the second book, the bit that was very pertinent to me right now was, and I'll read a bit from Bram's article. He says, and this is the final article, sorry, the final paragraph of the article. Just as I did with my first book, I find myself procrastinating. But this time, I have a whole array of appealing and seemingly productive writing-related opportunities to justify why I'm not sitting on my ass smashing out a manuscript. Panels, workshops, competitions to judge, hilarious literary salons where I read things I wrote when I was 12, drinks at the Moat with my new author buddies, guest blog posts, you name it, I'm having a ball. Just don't ask me how the second book's coming along. Kate, panels, literary salons, profitable side business. Still sounding very familiar.
I have no idea what you're talking about. This is not me or you at all.
Are these not good activities to be doing? Do you think it's a distraction from writing?
I think the answer to both of those questions is yes. Yes, it is absolutely a distraction from writing that us writers allow ourselves to get caught up into, particularly.
It's flattering too.
Oh my gosh. But you know, I also really resonated with the drinks at the Moat with author buddies because basically that's just what we do, right?
I resonated with the me reading something I wrote when I was 12. Like when you start getting desperate for material and just Googling things on your computer.
That pulling you wrote back. Previously. I need to put out, yes. It's so true. But I think, so yes, it is a distraction. Are they good things to be doing? Yes. Yes, they are good things to be doing because like we've talked about with so many of the writers that we've interviewed this season, there's the art part of the business, there's the writing part, and there's the doing the work for the book, and then there's this business part. And you could argue it's a distraction. Someone else cleverer than me could argue that it's a necessary part of building the...
Graham Simsion is like, only thing you should be doing is getting back in the seat and writing another book.
Yeah, well... Graham can say that because he sold...
A man of extremes.
Yeah, he's a man of extremes. He's definitely a man of extremes. But I think, you know, I've been guilty of this year. So I've had a up and down year with my manuscript, my second book. And I certainly kind of decided to then bleed myself into other writing related projects, including this podcast, instead of doing that work. But the time that I've taken away from the manuscript and the necessary kind of breathing space I've given it and all of the insights and other creative thinking I've been doing has fed back into that. So I think it's a necessary evil, but, and I don't even find it evil. Drinks at the Moat with all the buddies is awesome. And any opportunity I think to.
I think artificial condensing of, like I wrote the helpline probably for the first 3 or 4 years, an hour, hour and a half, max 2 hours a day. That's probably a good way for me to work.
Yeah.
Whereas this, you know, having a bit more time, maybe I'm only good for 2 hours a day.
Well, and also it's letting the writerly part of yourself maybe get too big for its boots. Like you hear people talk all the time about how they, you know, wrote this particular manuscript like in snatched bits, Kate Grenville on the, you know, on the boogie board in the back of the car while her mum was looking after the kids. People write with this urgency.
Did she?
Yeah. Yeah.
So where were the kids with the mum?
The kids with mum, and she drove somewhere, pulled a boogie board out and put it across her knees and typed away. Yeah. So, you know, that urgency and I've got no time to do this is when we actually get the work done. Whereas when you're luxuriating in all of the validation of being a proper grown-up writer who has to now produce something. More on second book syndrome in our next season, right?
In the entire second season. But I think that's it for now.
In this episode, we speak to Canberra writer and editor Ia McGold. This is one of three interviews we recorded on location with our partner, the ACT Writers' Centre in Canberra. You'll notice that the sound quality is slightly different to our normal smooth studio sound. Stick with it, though. Irma has so much great advice to offer from both sides of her publishing experience as writer and editor, from short stories to children's books, and so much more. Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming Canberra writer and editor Irma Gold to the first time. Irma Gold is an award-winning author and editor. Her debut collection of short fiction, Two Steps Forward, was published in 2011 by Affirm Press. Her short stories have also been widely published in journals and anthologies, including Mianjin, Island, Westerly, Review of Australian Fiction, award-winning Australian Stories 2017, and Australian Love Stories, edited by one of my favourites, Kate Kennedy.
Emma is also the author of 3 picture books for children, most recently Megumi and the Bear, with a 4th series story forthcoming. She's recently completed a novel, which won the New South Wales Writers Centre Varuna Fellowship and was supported with grants from CAPO and Arts ACT. Emma is ambassador for the ACT Chief Minister's Reading Challenge. And as an editor, Emma has worked both in-house and freelance. She's currently editor at Melbourne publisher Inkerman and Blunt and convener of editing at the University of Canberra. Emma, welcome.
Thank you.
It's so lovely to have you here in our little studio away from home here in Canberra. Emma, I want to begin by asking you if you can remember the first piece you ever had published.
Yes, it was a short story that I wrote for a competition for Reconciliation Week, I think it was, and it won. And there was an awards ceremony where, you know, the press was invited and I was handed this check and, you know, I had my photo taken for the paper and it was then published in an anthology. And so I thought, you know, this is what happens every time you win a competition.
How long ago was this?
Oh, it was a long time ago. It was when I was a creative writing student.
Okay.
I don't actually know, too long.
And had you had many rejections before this happened or was it just like bang straight in success?
I think that might have been the first competition that I'd entered.
Wow. So you enter a competition, you have this big ceremony and you think
this is how it is. And of course it's not because, you know, when you win a competition, normally you just get money in a certificate in the mail, you know. So I was like, oh, this is great. Though it was my first introduction to how newspaper photographers like to take the worst possible angle of you. So, you know, the photograph in the paper was taken, but he's lying on the ground looking up at us. Yeah.
No.
You give someone who doesn't have a double chin a double chin.
Oh, my goodness. Photographers and what they do.
And I think after that, that's when I started submitting to journals. And then I did get some rejections, as you do. But that first moment was so affirming. It was like, you know, somebody thinks my words are worth something. And because I was a creative writing student at the time, it really made me think, okay, well, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can be a writer.
And so did that sustain you? Did that feeling sustain you through then the rejections that came after? Or what was the feeling of the first rejection then if you started submitting stories to journals?
I think at that stage, I always actually didn't expect that it was going to be accepted.
Okay.
So, you know, I didn't have any expectation of actually having my work published. So I think probably now it's almost harder in a way once you've been published. But back then, I didn't really have any expectation about it. So every time something was accepted for publication, and I must say I didn't enter a lot of things while I was studying creative writing, but when something was accepted, you know, that was just an amazing feeling. That was the thing I focused on more than the rejection then.
And did you have an idea at this time that you were working towards? Did you ever think that you would publish a collection of short stories? Was that what you were working towards?
I didn't have that idea in my head then. I don't think I had any specific goal about what it was that I wanted to publish at that time. I just knew that I wanted to give writing a go and see if I could actually do it.
So tell us how your debut collection, Two Steps Forward, came about then. What's the distance between this first amazing feeling of publication and the moment when your book came out into the world?
It's quite a long time. So I started by publishing short stories in journals, and then I put this collection together. I did get a grant from Arts ACT, my first time of going and working at Varuna Writers Centre. Oh. And I remember I got the best room.
The big one.
The big one.
Oh, with the bath.
Yeah, but the irony was at the time I had a 6-month-old baby, and so I was actually only working there during the day, and then at night I would go, because I was still breastfeeding, and I would go to a hotel where my husband and my baby were. I was in the big room for a couple of days. Well, the first thing that happened was I remember sitting, because it's got like this lovely little alcove, like the window kind of sits out, and I was sitting at this desk writing, and I thought, oh my God, I'm a real writer. But what happened was after about 2 days of me being in this room, when the other writers realised I wasn't staying there at night, they said, oh, would you mind swapping?
Oh, no, no. That's so I not swapped. Fair. Have you ever had that room again?
I haven't had it since. I've been there maybe, I think, 4 times now and I've never got that room again. So, the collection was some short stories that have been previously published in places like Mianjin and Island Magazine, and then also some new stories that I actually wrote, a lot of those while I was at Varuna. And
at that time? with the 6-month-old.
Yes.
Wow.
I mean, it wasn't, that's, you know, I also wrote stories outside of that time.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you have a baby and you suddenly get this dedicated time, you just really use
go
that.
For it.
Yeah, you do. You absolutely go for it. And so I put together this collection and I sent it to Affirm Press because they had a call out for submissions. So they had a new series that they were putting together called Long Story Shorts, and that was publishing 6 short fiction collections over the period of a year. And they got 450 submissions.
Wow.
Yeah. And originally my collection was shortlisted. And then I got an email to say that it had in fact been rejected. So it hadn't made it through.
Gosh.
And the publisher, Martin Hughes, said to me, would I like some feedback? So I, of course, said, yes, I would. And he went away to look at the 2 readers' reports, and they were so conflicting that he couldn't actually put anything useful together for me. So he did this amazing thing and went over his Christmas holidays to read my manuscript so that he could give me feedback. But what actually happened was that he loved the book, and then he handed it to the senior editor, who also loved it. And the next thing I knew was I was getting a phone call saying that they wanted to offer me a publishing contract.
Oh my goodness. That is such a good story. So did you find out afterwards, like, who were the readers? Not who were they specifically, but they had just taken that feedback on board, the 2 reader reports, and not gone forward with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, that happens in publishing houses and also with agents too, where they have people who they commission for readers' reports. So they had 450 manuscripts, so that's their first process.
Of course.
So, I mean, that was just, it was amazing. I couldn't believe it.
From utter despair to utter elation.
Yeah.
And Emma, were you already working in publishing at this point?
I was, yeah.
And so did that experience give you a different kind of take on what publishing would be like in terms of a, you know, new kind of greenie like I was, who didn't have any idea of what it was all going to be like? Did the experience of working in publishing mean you knew what was coming at you with publishing a book?
In terms of
what it was like to have something out in the world that people would be reviewing, in terms of the idea of marketing it?
In yes and no.
Okay.
I mean, practically speaking, yes. But what that means in terms of actually dealing with all of that, no. I mean, one of the things I found that I didn't realise was how emotionally exhausting it is always talking about yourself and your book. And, you know, after a book comes out, you're just endlessly talking about yourself. And as someone who's an introvert, and a lot of writers are introverts, yep, talking about yourself endlessly doesn't come naturally. Yep. So that was something that I didn't expect. The other thing that I didn't expect was that particularly with literary fiction, people often conflate the characters with you. So they think that, even though it's fiction, they think that actually it's autobiographical. And I really didn't expect that to the level that, yes, you know, it happened. So in fact, even a couple of weeks ago, somebody who read 2 Steps Forward said to me, oh, you must have had some terrible boyfriends.
Wow.
I was like, no, I didn't. So, you know, I'm not, there's this idea that they teach you in creative writing, write what you know.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's fine for some people and that works. But for me, I've always been more interested in writing from what I know into what I don't know.
Yeah.
So writing about other experiences that I haven't actually lived and exploring that and coming to understand that and putting myself into other scenarios. But I did have this one really funny experience. It was just before 2 Steps Forward came out. And there was somebody who designed all 6 collections. And I met him actually at the launch for the book that came out before mine, Leah Swann's book. And when I was introduced to him, he had this really shocked look on his face, which I thought, oh, that's really odd. And it turned out that there's one of the stories in the collection, which is one of the longer stories, is about this young girl called Abby who lives in a caravan and has this, you know, kind of awful mother. And he thought the story had really moved him, so it made him cry, and he felt
story
for this character, and he thought that I was Abby grown up. And I don't know what he thought Abby looked like, but obviously I didn't look like what he imagined she looked like. And he said to me, oh, but have you lived in a caravan? And I said, no, I don't think I've even ever stayed in a caravan, actually. And he said, but how do you know what it's like? And you know, that's what fiction is. It's imagining yourself into that scenario and how that would feel. And the thing that's so funny is, you know, with Megumi and the bear, nobody would ever say to me, oh, so when did you play in the forest with a bear?
Yeah.
You know, we know that's the product of my imagination. But I think, I guess because literary fiction feels so real, in a way it's flattering, you know, that
yes,
that people can't imagine that you could write that unless you'd lived it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that did...
And I wonder if that comes specifically or more so for short story as well, because I feel like across the length of a novel, people might also say, okay, yeah, I get that that's not your experience. But in that, short stories coming at you, particularly when you dive into a collection like someone would with yours and read all the way through, that I wonder if people are astonished that you could come up with that range of experience as well.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because it's not like it's all the same characters. You know, there are all sorts of characters in that book. So I thought that was interesting, you know, that they had. I think there's this funny thing these days, or maybe it's always been the case, where we think that memoir has elements of fiction and, you know, fiction has elements of memoir.
And I think, do you agree that there's also that kind of, that almost cult of the author and the author's life and wanting to know everything about who the author is and the story behind the book? You know, we kind of are asked to do that part of marketing so much. I don't know if that's always been the case.
Yeah, I think that's becoming more the case. And, you know, that's to do with sales and trying to sell the book, and the story behind the book is often really interesting to people. And I definitely think that's becoming more the case. And I suppose also the prevalence of social media, because, you know, as authors, we're always on, you know, and need to be on social media, and you're talking about yourself and what you're doing. And again, that's the story behind the book and what's happening. So I suppose it makes sense, but it has taken me by surprise sometimes. And also because some of my characters, I think, oh my God, do you think that I would do that as a parent, for example? That horrifies me.
Yes.
I wrote this one story, which actually isn't in that collection, about a mother who has a young child and they're staying in a hotel, and she locks the child into the hotel overnight and goes out to a bar and stays out all night. And that came from actually an anecdote that I'd heard. But God, I'd be horrified if anyone thought that I did that.
It's part of the mystery of being the author, right? Well, you guess. Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. Emma, you mentioned then the difference with Megumi and the bear. No one would expect that was your experience. What were the other kinds of differences that you picked up on marketing and the publishing of picture books as opposed to your fiction collection?
A lot of it's really the same, but, you know, with picture books, there's these lovely things they can do. So, for example, with Megumi and the bear, you know, it's set in the snow, she's wearing a scarf, and, you know, with the first lot of books that went out to bookshops, they included a knitting pattern so you could make your own Megumi scarf, which
that
was just
so
adorable.
Delightful.
I know, I loved that. I was like, oh, my
picture
goodness.
Book.
Yeah. And I suppose the other main thing is, I mean, you're doing all the same kinds of things, but the audience is different. So doing a book launch with adults and a book launch with kids, two totally different things. And of course, you're doing also a huge number of school visits, and, you know, you have to keep kids engaged the whole time. And the other thing, the really lovely thing, is that when kids love your book, like, they come up and throw their arms around you, and just, it's just the most beautiful thing, you know, to know that child love your book so much that they just want to hug you and or ask you for your phone number. I had one girl ask for my phone number because she needed to stay in touch with me. And
that's great.
And the things that they say, because they're so honest and they're so genuine, they will just always tell you like it is. And you know, with adults you never quite know, but with kids
they are real.
Yeah, absolutely. So that is delightful, that whole side of things.
And Emma, had you done school, had you kind of been in that world of visiting schools and talking about reading and books before Megumi and the Bear came out, or was that all new to you?
No, that was all new. I hadn't done any of that with the two previous books that came out. I hadn't done any of that. So Megumi and the Bear was the first kind of experience of doing all of that. And I feel like now with my next book that's coming out, I feel like I'm going to be able to be a bit more systematic's not really the right word, but I know how to do all of that in a much better way, I think.
Because was that something that your publisher kind of offered to you or pushed to you, or was it something that you established on your own, contacting schools and them contacting you?
No, that was something I did myself.
Yeah.
And since doing that, there's, you know, there's a lot more avenues, I think. So I would do that more broadly than I did it last time. But it is, you know, it is really one of the most lovely things, going into schools and talking to kids about reading. And after you go and you get the feedback from the teachers, I had this one class that I did with Megumi and the Bear, where they had 8 autistic kids in the class. And they said after I left, they were just so enthusiastic. And during the presentation as well, they said they'd never seen them so well behaved.
Wow.
So that was so lovely. And, you know, after you leave, you hear that they've all been like making their own books. And it's just so lovely.
That's interesting, because one of the things I wanted to ask you about was a post on your blog, and we'll link to this in the show notes, where you summed up some of the things that you and other writers wished that you had known before you published. And the first thing that you said was, your heart is published along with your book. So you've given this beautiful idea of what the readers of Megumi and the Bear give back to you. Can you tell us a bit more about that idea, that your heart's published along with your book?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, before your book's published, you know, writing's such an isolated business. And usually for me, you know, I've been working on a novel for adults recently, and, you know, I'll have a few readers of that. So other writers I know who will be readers for me. And then, of course, you know, it goes to your editor at the publishing house, but there's a very limited number of people who've seen it. And then once it's published, you know, it goes out into the world and it's up for comment, you know, and it's a really vulnerable time, you know. There's this idea that the book is not you and you are not the book. So any criticism of your book is a criticism of the book and not of you. But actually, it's such a personal thing. You know, you've created this thing and suddenly it's out in the world and people can take it however they take it. And I was really lucky with Two Steps Forward that I had really good reviews. But there was this one review where there was this one sentence in it, and I couldn't work out exactly what the sentence meant. I think the sub-editors had got to it. And it, so it didn't really make sense, but it sounded like it could be negative. And so I was like reading this sentence over and over again. And I'm saying to my husband, do you think it means this or do you think it means that? And he's like, I don't know, maybe it means this. I'm like, oh my God, it could mean that. And then after about 10 minutes of this, I just thought, this is ridiculous. Like, nobody else, everyone else is just going to read that and go, well, that sentence doesn't make sense, yeah, and move on to the next one. So I think you do kind of, you know, agonize over that. And the other one I had for Megumi and the Bear, again, I had really good reviews, but there was this one review on a website for teachers, written by a teacher. And so Megumi and the Bear, it's about a little girl who meets a bear in the forest, and they play and have a wonderful time together, and then he disappears, and this is winter. And she's wishing and wishing for the bear to come back. And eventually in spring he does. And when I say to the kids, you know, 4 or 5 year olds or older or whatever, but I'll say to them, well, where do you think the bear is? And they all know the bear's hibernating. But on this website, the teacher said, oh, and the bear disappears, and it's never explained where the bear was. So that was kind of confusing. And I thought, oh my God, the kids get it. But, you know, this is up on a website for teachers. Yes. So other teachers who haven't seen the book are going to read that and go, oh, well, I'm not going to get that book. So, but I suppose the thing is, you always remember the one, like, you don't, I don't remember a single word from any of the good reviews. You know, you only, those are the ones that kind of stick with you.
Don't you think that's part of the fear too, that idea that other people are going to see this negative review? And I always remember thinking, are they going to worry that I'm not coping with the terrible, you know, like there's this feeling of it then going out into the world and being distributed like to the other teachers, where it kind of, it just makes the pain of it all the worse.
I try and remind myself of that thing where, because, you know, when you actually get mostly good reviews and you see, like, say, for example, a friend's book's published and you think, wow, it's getting great reviews. And you might read a sentence or a paragraph or whatever that's critical, but you don't actually retain that because you think, overall, great reviews.
Great review.
It's only the author who goes, oh my God. So I try and remind myself of that you're the only one who cares that deeply. Like, nobody else cares that much, and everybody else has better perspective.
Yeah.
Everybody else thinks, oh, well, overall, great reviews. The book's doing great. It's out there. And, you know, so.
Do you have a policy now? Do you have a policy that is, you know, I don't read Goodreads, or I don't look at newspaper reviews, or I look at them all and then put them away?
I just don't believe people who say they don't read reviews. That's true.
I totally read them.
I haven't avoided Goodreads so far, but I've been very lucky on there. So I feel like I should touch wood or something because it's just a matter of time. Goodreads, I think, in general, is a pretty agonizing place for authors to be. At least, you know, the reviews when you've got, you know, in the newspapers or the magazines or, you know, a blogger who is a really good book blogger.
Yeah.
They're giving thoughtful, critical feedback. But, you know, on Goodreads and, you know, the internet, they're just random people. And I think it's better not to put too much weight on those kind of reviews.
Excellent advice. Emma, I wanted to ask about your involvement in the writing and publishing community because it seems like you're incredibly involved in lots of different aspects of it, as well as being quite active on social media and a blogger. How does that community help you along the way, or who helped you along the way, and how do you help others?
Oh, so much. Like, it's just invaluable. I think, you know, as I was saying, writing, you're by yourself in a room in your own head, and just being with other writers and being able to get out of that and talk to other people about what they're experiencing and what they're going, I mean, you're all experiencing similar things, and you've got people who you can share in, you know, the celebrations, like when things go really well, and commiserate when things don't go so well, because publishing is a really tough business and I think it's actually getting harder and harder. So having that support network of people around me is just absolutely invaluable. And, you know, in Canberra, we have such a wonderful writing community. Probably everyone feels that about their, yeah. their place.
We feel that
acknowledgement. Yeah, yeah. Everyone thinks they've got the best community, but we really do. And also, you know, in the writing itself, like I had this, so I've just finished this novel and I've got a short, well, it was a short fiction writing group. There's just four of us who would meet like once a month and, you know, talk about writing and stuff as well as actually looking at each other's work. And, you know, I just always come away from those just on an absolute high. Like, it's just so fantastic. And I had 1 month given my group a short story and they said to me, well, this is great, but what happens next? And I thought, okay. So I went away and I wrote another short story, thinking it would be like a linked short story. And I came back and gave it to my group and they were like, well, this is great, but what happens next?
Oh, wow.
And John Clancy, who is a brilliant, brilliant writer of short fiction and novels, and I think is not as well known as he should be in Australia, and he said to me, might you actually be writing a novel? And I was like, oh my God, I'm writing a novel.
Oh, I love that question.
And so then I applied for a grant, went to Thailand because I needed to do some more research and started the process of actually writing this novel. So the first one, the first what I thought was a story, which was actually published in Westerly, was actually the first chapter of the novel. And so that wouldn't have come about without that group of writers. You know, that whole novel exists because of that group of writers.
That's fantastic.
So, you know, it's just in so many ways, I'm just so grateful for the writers that I have around me.
You've talked a couple of times, you've mentioned different funding opportunities, including Varuna as well. How did they assist you in your writing?
In so many ways, because, well, with the novel, you know, being able to go over to Thailand and do the research that I need to do, like, it's simply in financial terms, I couldn't afford that. So it actually enabled me to write that book. And I also got funding from Arts ACT for actual writing time, which, because I work as an editor, it's really hard to actually carve out yes. that time. And so that kind of a grant that actually just lets you do that is incredible. It's just such a gift. And I've been very lucky with funding actually. I think most of my books have been supported by funding of some kind for development, and just being able to take up those opportunities, going to Varuna, I mean, that's just such an amazing place. Every writer should go.
Yes, I know, it was such a gift. I should put a disclaimer that Emma and I met at Varuna. Yes. And it's an incredible place to yeah. write, and for the writing community
yeah.
that is fostered there.
Yeah, I mean, it's got that amazing balance of you write by yourself during the day, but then in the evening, all the writers come together and just talk writing, and it's such a brilliant balance. Plus, of course, Sheila feeds
oh
you.
Oh my gosh.
There should be some little shrine for Sheila. Like, so all Sheila. The writers that have been to Varuna who just know how amazing Sheila
yeah,
is.
That you just yeah. talk about Sheila.
And having someone to cook for you for a whole week yes. is bliss.
Do you put aside time, like specific time in your year or your work plan where you apply for, you say, okay, this is my time that I will work on applications for grants or funding? Is that,
no.
do you think about it like that?
No. Okay. No. I've only ever where I've got something that I want to do or that I'm working on, and, you know, I know that X funding opportunity is coming up, and so then I will do
it. It's just a good match.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, great. You've got the new novel that you're working on, as well as this forthcoming children's picture book. What's become easier and what's become harder in the kind of publication process for you?
Yeah. What's become easier is, I suppose, you know what to expect. So you know what's going to happen once the book goes out there with publicity. You know what you need to do, and you know what a roller coaster ride it is as well. So you're kind of prepared for that. And I think, you know, that does actually make a big difference, because the first time that happens, it's really quite daunting, and there's so much going on and all sorts of emotions, and, you know, so knowing how that all works is really useful. In terms of what's become more difficult, I think the waiting. I actually find the waiting has become harder. I'm so much less patient.
Isn't it funny? And also because you're an editor, like, you know about what happens in that lag time, whereas there's so many writers are like, why does it take so long to get from where I hand it over to where I can see it on the shelf? But you know what's
going. I do, and I still find the waiting frustrating. And with my next children's book, Cerise Story, that will have taken 6 years from the point that it was accepted for publication to when it actually comes out.
Okay, that is a long wait.
That is really long. I mean, it's partly because, you know, with picture books, if you have a high-profile illustrator, you often have to wait 2 or 3 years because they're booked up in advance. And so Wayne Harris is illustrating this book, and I think the wait will, by the time he starts, it will be about 3 years. And there were also internal changes at Walker Books, my publisher, so I think that changed the timeline. So, yeah, 6 years is a really long time to wait. But there's all kinds of waiting. Like, I've got another picture book that is going to an acquisitions meeting, so it's waiting to hear about that. I've got my literary fiction novel that I've just finished, that I've just got an agent for, and that will go out to publishers, and then it's waiting, you know, it's all waiting. And then, as you say, like, when you're waiting for the edits to come back, that's when I don't mind that so much, because, like, you know, I know what's going on at the other end, because I think sometimes authors just think, why is the editor not getting back to me? Yeah, they're really, really busy.
They are really busy. Do you find that having different projects on the go and your work in editing as well, that helps soften the blow a little of the waiting period?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, you're not just sitting around twiddling your thumbs, you're actually just getting on and doing other stuff. Yeah, I think that's really important, that I am doing other editing work and all the, you know, the other kinds of things that go along with writing and editing, as well as trying to fit in some actual writing. But I do think focusing on another writing project is, like, a really good antidote to the waiting.
Yes, it is. It's like the reward that you get, isn't it? Okay, yeah. Let's start something new.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, because you've been involved in the hard copy program, which Catherine is alumni of, and I wanted to ask you about how you see that helping, or what was your role and how you see that helping writers kind of break into the world of publishing.
Yeah, it's a fantastic program, and I think it's a really unique program. There's nothing else that's really actually quite like it in Australia at the moment, and I think they're into maybe their fifth year now.
Okay.
And I was involved in 2016 with three other authors assessing the manuscripts that were going to be selected for the program. So that was fantastic to be involved in that small way. It's a really privileged thing, actually, to be involved in that kind of a process. And I think that often it's a really steep learning curve for the people who come into hard copy, because they just have access to all of these incredible professionals from all around Australia. And a lot of them don't have very much knowledge of the publishing industry. So they just learn this huge amount. And, you know, the way that they have access to all of these different, you know, editors and publicists and agents, you know, it's incredible. So I think, it's been wonderful to just be a very small part of that.
I wanted to ask you about life with your editor hat on, because you've also edited a number of anthologies and you see a lot of manuscripts in your work. What are you looking for when you first see a manuscript?
One of the things that usually stands out is the voice, and, you know, a work with a really strong voice, that's what you're looking for. I think, though, the voice, it's one of the hardest things to kind of precisely define. When I talk to my editing students about it, I break it down into, you know, syntax and punctuation and rhythm and use of language, you know, all of those things. But when you're actually reading a work, you're not analysing it in that way. It's just you know, a voice will kind of leap out and grab you. And, you know, as editors, you're looking for really the X factor. It's that thing in a manuscript that you actually can't define, you know, the kind of the spark or the heart that lives inside that manuscript that just makes you sit up and take notice. So, yeah, a really strong voice.
Does your eye for that X factor sharpen over time?
That's a good question. I don't know. I would hope so.
Yeah.
But the thing is with a voice, you know, you know that from the first moment that you start reading it. It's evident in that first page. So it's just immediately stands out to you, a strong voice. You immediately know this book has got something.
What can you tell writers about how to best work with an editor? How do you work with an editor well, I suppose? What do you look for?
I would say it's a collaboration, so be open to that. Be open to the whole process, because often, particularly with newer writers, I don't think they understand what that editing process is actually like, and so they're often quite taken by surprise. They think they've submitted a finished, perfect manuscript, and they don't realise, like particularly through the substantive process, that there are actually a huge amount of changes that can be made.
Just begun.
Yeah, that's right. It is. So, yeah, that's exactly right. So you think, oh, you know, you're finished, and then actually you're not. And so I think that does take a lot of authors by surprise. But I would say be really open to that, because, you know, having a really good collaboration between an editor and an author, that's how the best work emerges. And it really is a conversation. So it's a to and fro. It's not the editor saying, oh, you should do this. It's actually a conversation, and together you're making the work better and improving it. So it can really be the best work that it can be.
As you're talking to me, I can almost see Irma, the editor, and Irma, the writer, as two different, like you almost have different body language. So, and I wanted to ask you, what does Irma, the editor, teach Irma, the writer? Like, how do you change between those hats?
Well, I think being a writer means, when I'm working as an editor, I actually have empathy for how challenging that editing process can be emotionally, you know. And sometimes, you know, the process, it can be a long one. And, you know, sometimes authors get to usually near the end of the copy editing process where they're just over it. They just actually don't really care anymore.
I don't want to see it anymore. Don't show me the manuscript.
Yeah. But hopefully you have a really strong relationship with your editor and really good trust in your editor by that point, so that, you know, the editor can really help sort of carry things through that just last little phase. But it was really interesting for me as a writer when I was going through the editing of Two Steps Forward to experience that. And I did get to that point where I was like, oh my God, I hate this book. Why are they even publishing it? I don't care if that comma is a semicolon. Like, I don't care. And then, of course, by the time the book comes out again, you love it again.
Yes. Thank goodness there's an editor there who cares so much about the semicolon.
Yeah, that's right. And also, I think the other thing is, when you're working on all of the things that can be improved about the book, I think a lot of authors need to be reminded that the editor still loves the book.
Yeah.
And I felt that as an author. And so I'm really aware of that as an editor. So I do think being an author does make me a better editor, not necessarily in the way I work on the manuscript, but more in the way I'm actually communicating with the author. And in terms of, you know, working as an editor, when you're always looking at how you can improve things in other people's work, because it's so much easier to see things in other people's work. Like, I, as a writer, I need an editor just the same as everybody else. You know, there are things in other people's work that you see immediately that you just don't see in your own. But I do start to consciously, you know, get better at identifying some of those things. So just little things, like all authors have their go-to words, like the ones that they just automatically use without even thinking. And when you read somebody else's manuscript, it's so obvious, you know. But so for me as a writer, I go, okay, what are my go-to words?
Yeah.
You have to actually assess for yourself and start looking at those and eliminating those. So it is useful. And I think, you know, pacing, for example, is something I've learned a lot about working as an editor, which isn't something that I necessarily thought about when I was starting out as an author. So I definitely think I am a better editor from being a writer and a better writer from being an editor.
Oh, that's so interesting. Many of the writers we've interviewed have spoken about that tension between being kind of actively engaged in the literary world, especially around publication, doing promotion, doing events, doing paid work, and making time for their writing as well, which you talked a little bit about. How have you over time managed those different aspects of your career?
Yeah, it's really hard. It's just a lot of juggling. Editing is my paid work. It's how I make my living. So that does have to take priority. And then, you know, I've got three kids. I teach at uni. And there are all those, you know, other events and kinds of things that you mentioned that you're doing. So, you know, like after this interview, for example, we've got an event tonight. And then tomorrow, first thing, I get up and I drive down the South Coast to give a workshop on writing picture books. And then when I come back, I've got a school visit for the Chief Minister's Reading Challenge because I'm an ambassador for that. So there's all these other things as well. And I find, too, that they take up a lot of headspace. So when I've got a school visit, for example, coming up, it takes up some headspace, even when, you know, you're not actually doing it. And actually the last couple of months, because I work freelance as an editor, so I'm working for publishers and also for individual authors, whether it's authors who want to be self-published or authors who are preparing their manuscript to send to a publisher. And with freelance, you just have to ride the highs and the lows. And there's always periods where there's just so much work. And I've just, the last 2 months, I've just barely been able to breathe for the amount of editing work that I've had. And I realized that I was being a bit grumpy. Yeah, okay. And it's because, you know, I love the editing work and I don't think I would actually ever give it up. But for me, it's a balance. And the last 2 months, I haven't been able to write. And then this week, I was able to actually carve out a bit of writing time. And it was just so incredible, you know. I know there's some writers who say they don't actually enjoy the actual writing, but I just absolutely love it. That is my happy place. Yeah. And so I've been in a better mood this week.
Right.
But so it is really hard. It's just permanently juggling.
Yeah. You've given us already heaps of advice that I hope that the listeners will be able to take away. But specifically for Catherine, who's come all the way from the hard copy program and now is about to leap into publishing, you know, her first book or her first book coming out, what kind of advice can you give to her about navigating this bit?
I would say, practically speaking, the publicist only has a short amount of time to work on your book, and then after that, maybe after 4 to 6 weeks, they will move on to the next lot of books. So I think it's really useful to know that before you go into it, because you have to really maximize that time. And because after that, you're on your own and, you know, you're going to be doing all of the stuff yourself, so you want to really maximize that time. And I think the other thing is, it is such a roller coaster. It's not just physically about all of the things you're doing. It is also that emotional thing of having your heart published along with your book. And particularly if you're an introvert like I am, I think it's really important to just take some time to step back from that and just, you know, have some time to kind of recoup, or, you know, go and read a book and drink a cup of tea, or go for a walk, or go to a cafe and eat cake, like whatever it is that is the thing that is good for you to do to kind of get back to a quiet place. And also to try and enjoy it, which sounds weird because I think you think when your book's published that it's just going to be incredible all
everything
the time.
Will be,
yeah, it will be amazing, amazing. But I don't know, in so many ways it's kind of gut-wrenching, and I think, you know, to just try and actually sit back and think, because there are 20,000 books published in Australia every year. So I think also you have to manage your expectations too about what's going to happen. And a lot of people talk about, I haven't really experienced this because I feel like I'm always so busy, I've always got something else to do, but I know a lot of people have talked about, like, the day the book comes out, it's just like crickets, you know? And you're expecting the whole world to be going, hooray, yep, your book's out, you know. So I think it's also good to know how many books are published every year, because your book is just one book swimming in that massive ocean of 20,000 books every year. But then also to just sit back and also remember that, like, only 1% of all books that are submitted to publishers ever make it to publication. So if you think about 20,000, that must be like 2 million books actually every year.
Yeah.
So yours is one out of that. So that's also a really amazing achievement in itself. And just maybe, like, sit back and reflect on that too.
That is excellent advice. Everyone go away and think on those numbers. Irma, it has been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us on The First Time.
Thank you.
So, Emma Gold, I'm going to ask you our first time quick five. Don't forget, you're allowed to pass on any question. For your first time, were you agented or unagented?
Unagented.
Advance or no advance?
Advance.
Overseas territories sold or just Australia and New Zealand?
For Megumi and the Bear, it went to the UK.
Nice. Excellent. Festival invites or no festival invites?
Yes, I did a lot of events and some of them were festivals.
And do you know how many copies sold?
I don't.
Do you make it a specific thing that you don't check?
Yeah, I don't really want to get hung up on that. Because yeah. Also because I know, and this is now not a quick answer.
No, that's okay.
Also because I know working in publishing what the kind of figures are. And I think actually for new time authors, they're often lower.
Tell us, what are the figures?
It varies depending on genre and you know, all those kind of things. But I think first-time authors often surprise. They think their sales will be higher than they actually are.
Food for thought. Thank you so much. And Emma, can you tell us a favourite novel by a debut author?
This is really hard because I have to say I've read so many really good debuts, especially in the last couple of years. But I think I will have to say Lucy Trelaw's Salt Creek, which I just absolutely loved. And I don't know if it's on the school curriculum, but if it's not, it should be. So it is set in the mid-1800s, and it's about a family who take up some land in South Australia. And the way that the family kind of unravels through that, and also the local Indigenous people as well. And it's just so beautifully written and completely broke my heart.
It does. It really does.
And I just think everyone should read it.
Excellent. Thank you.
To find out more about Emma Gold, go to our show notes for this episode at thefirsttimepodcast.com. And don't forget to share the love if you're liking the podcast. Or let us know what you think at thefirsttimepod on Twitter and Instagram. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Ady and Harry Morris. The First Time Podcast is created with the support of Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, and RMIT School of Media and Communication.